Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new survey by Pew Research Center reveals that 76% of adults believe their libraries do a good job serving the learning and educational needs of their community. But most of those respondents were also unaware of the extent to which modern libraries are equipped to do that job. Educating the public about what it offers is a big component of the 16-month, $35 million renovation of the main library of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Coming up, we'll hear more details about the renovation and the library's grand reopening this weekend with Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO Pat Lazinski and the principal architect of the firm behind the project. Joining us now is Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center, Lee Rainey. Welcome back, Lee.
Hey, Ann. Great to be with you.
Americans like their libraries. It's kind of like their politicians, right?
They do like their libraries. They actually think much more highly of their libraries than they think of their politicians. We do that kind of comparative work. And there are a couple of ways they talk about that. The first is that they, in many cases, say that if the local library closed, it would be devastating to the local community. They think that libraries provide resources and services that other institutions don't. They think they help people gain access to information and knowledge that would otherwise be hard to get to. And people just like the idea that their library sort of is a central anchor institution of their community that speaks for the whole community, that provides things to people who might not otherwise have the chance to get stuff. So it levels the playing field.
Do the results differ very much or significantly, I should say, among demographics or between demographics?
Well, the people who like libraries most include parents of minor children. Those folks are very aware of library programming, not just the services of getting and borrowing books and things like that, but the reading programs and the library days and things like that. So parents, especially moms, are very tuned into libraries. Women are more likely to say nice things about libraries than men are. And people who have higher levels of education and income are also very enthusiastic about libraries. But then when we ask about new kinds of services, like some of those that I'm sure are part of the master plan in Columbus, minorities, both African Americans and Latinos and poorer families, are very anxious to see the menu of library services expanded to make sure that it sort of keeps up with modern times, including digital technology.
They're very good users of libraries.
Yes, and one of the things that's so appealing to everybody in the community is that libraries are serving populations that might be struggling with access to information and knowledge in other ways.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This hour, we're talking about the modern library. Right now, I'm talking with Lee Rainey. He's Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center about a recent study on American attitudes toward their local libraries. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right now, I want to bring in Pat Lazinski. He's Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Thank you, Ann.
Lee Rainey is just talking about what matters to people, and it's an interesting dichotomy in a way. Most Americans love their libraries, but a lot of them don't know what their libraries have to offer.
You know, that dichotomy is something that always is actually a little bit strange to us when it's explained to us, because I think there's a segment of people who don't understand what's happening in libraries, but in Columbus, we have near 70% of the population with library cards. We have 6.5 million visits a year to all of our locations, and, you know, someone knows what's going on, and we think the public generally does know and appreciate and values and support and uses our libraries at record numbers.
Right. We talked earlier, Lee Rainey, most Americans like their library but don't know what they offer these days. Where's the disconnect then? Where do you see that?
Well, libraries have been so deeply into innovation and embracing new things and expanding service offerings and programs that I think it's hard for some people in the public just to keep up. Like it's 62% of Americans know that their local libraries lend e-books now, but that's still a significant portion who don't know that, even though over 90% of local libraries now are lending e-books. A lot of people, as a matter of fact, almost a majority, don't know that there are online programs that libraries offer that certify people for that they've mastered new skills. So libraries are in the midst of this big, interesting innovation and transition period, and it's, you know, sometimes it's hard for people to stay on top of everything that's happening.
And you're right. So it's a matter of what you want and need. And the problem is we don't see a lot of billboards up there telling us what's new at the library, Pat Lisinski. You can't do that.
Well, we work a lot, obviously, on earned media and word of mouth. And really, our staff being finely tuned to understanding our customers and the needs that they really have. I think many of your listeners, Ann, would be surprised to learn that there's a large number of people who rely on the library for access to the digital grid. You go into any of our libraries, particularly the neighborhood libraries, and you see banks of computers all in one area, all filled, and you see people waiting around the perimeter to gain access to the internet. And you know, this is all for us. It's highly automated. It's between 1.8 and 1.9 reservations of an hour long or more per year. And for people who are in the professional world juggling a phone and an iPad and a laptop, it never even occurs to them that this might be happening. But again, there may be folks who, many people have a smartphone, but a smartphone, it's difficult to do everything on the smartphone. So being able to use the library, either because you don't have broadband access or because you have five people in the home and you're just looking for greater capacity, that's what the neighborhood public library offers. And that's just scratching the surface. For us, there's so much more.
That's probably true. So truly, Rainey, when we're talking about that, those groups of people who are the biggest users, pound for pound, of libraries, minorities, Latino, African Americans, and that sort. That's where the digital divide occurs.
It does, and they really appreciate libraries for access to modern technology. One of the great and sort of not necessarily widely heralded stories of the past generation is that most people now know that libraries have rebranded themselves as tech hubs.
Yeah.
So at the same level of appreciation and interest and enthusiasm that people talk about being able to borrow books for free from libraries, they speak now about access to computers, internet connectivity. And I'm sure it's true in Columbus that not only during library hours do people use the computer banks that Pat was talking about, but there are sometimes when after hours people will just go and sit in the library parking lot and jack into the Wi-Fi system because that's the best access they can get and they don't want to go over the data cap on their smartphones and things like that. So there are ways that libraries are becoming 24/7 institutions that are really appealing to people.
And Lee, we call that the blue screen effect in the parking lot at night when you do see those cars in our lots indeed tapping into the wireless. And I think many of us learned about that firsthand during Hurricane Katrina, because while many of the libraries were destroyed, they still had wireless access, and people were in those lots tapping in for their, for the applications for flood relief and all of the rest. That was happening in the library because it is that community center that not only serves daily needs, but in times of crisis, libraries really matter.
The Ohio Historical Society changed its name to the Ohio History Connection. Library is a word that comes from, I guess, Latin libre, which is a book, right? And is library the right word anymore? Or I wouldn't want to see it change personally. I'm not suggesting that, but is it a word by changing the name of what you are? Would that make a difference?
I've actually had a few people mention that to me in town, And I chuckle because I say there is so much brand equity in the library and the Columbus Metropolitan Library. I'm going to leave that for the next CEO. I'm not going to tackle that one. I think we're in a good spot.
Did that come up at all in your research, Lee Rainey?
It comes up in a really interesting way, and we asked people for the first time in a recent survey, do you think of yourself as a lifelong learner? And 73% of American adults self-identify as that. And I think a big thing happened at the beginning of the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, when there was so much anxiety and so much stress in the workplace, where people were essentially reckoning of their own capacities in the future. Do I have the skills I'll need for the jobs of the future? How long will my employer stay in business? Will my industry be disrupted by technology? And people now are thinking about libraries as one of the cluster of the educational ecosystem of their communities, and a big part of it. One of the things that we're just getting new data on, and I will talk a little bit about at the American Library Association conference this coming weekend, is that lots of people use those library computers now to take courses, either for certification or for a credential that's going to help them with a new job.
Talking about those learning clusters and those educational clusters, that's very true of where the main library is situated in downtown Columbus. Pat Lazinski?
Not only in the main, but I'm going to go back to the neighborhood branches as well. Maine had that experience before we closed, and of course we're so excited to reopen this Saturday. But in the neighborhood branches is where you really see those requests coming forward. We had a local software company, AWH.net, that came to us with a program that we're still developing. But we have some wonderful pilots underway where we're actually teaching coding to unemployed adults that actually lead to internships in the IT world. We think there is no greater use of a facility like a library where we have training space, where others who are in the industry can come in and share their expertise, share their knowledge, frankly, give back to the community. But in neighborhoods where unemployment might be higher, to actually have that happen and turn into jobs, suddenly we're talking about libraries at workforce optimization. We wouldn't have used those words 10 or 15 years ago, but I think Lee's research bears it out, and it's our experience in Columbus that's very popular and richly satisfying as well.
Lee Rainey, what kind of person is a regular user of the library?
Well, it's everybody. They're so interesting to watch the demographic results of our surveys, because the libraries are one of the rare institutions that serves of just the widest possible diversity of sources. And one of the striking things in the preamble that you read to this segment, and you were talking about, you know, the dusty, dark places where books are borrowed. One of the things that people are wrong about, we found, the conventional wisdom is completely upside down, is that young people don't read and young people don't go to libraries anymore. In fact, our data show that young people are among the strongest library enthusiasts, and their reading levels of books in all forms, both printed and digital and audiobooks, is as high or higher than their elders. And so there's a way that libraries are adapting to the times and serving just a really broad cross-section of their communities.
Well, Lee Rainey, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Great to be with you.
Lee Rainey, Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center. We're going to dig in and talk about the renovated main library of the Columbus Metropolitan Library when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Libraries are supposed to serve as the technological and informational hub of a community. And back in the day, before computers and smartphones, Americans flocked to their libraries for everything from periodicals to recipes to fiction, nonfiction, research, and a quiet place to study. What we need from our libraries has changed, however, and libraries across the country are changing to meet those needs. Today, we want to introduce you to your new main library of the Columbus Metropolitan Library, which reopens this weekend after a $35 million renovation. The footprint of the building did not change, but almost everything about the interior has. Joining us now, Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO Pat Lozinski. And once again, thanks for joining us today, Pat.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
Also joining us, the principal architect at the Gund Partnership, which collaborated on the renovation with Schooley Caldwell, David Zink. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
How did you develop, between you and all of the people you worked with, a formula for what you wanted the library to be? Pat Lozinski, why don't you start us off? How did you even begin?
Well, I think it begins actually before David's involvement and our understanding that the greatest opportunity and new asset to leverage that would be a part of the main library was the access to Topiary Park. I can't tell you the number of times that people have stood either in my office or in some part of the main library, and I've talked about this wonderful asset. The Topiary Park, I think, is close to a 10-acre park and off of Town Street, Town and Washington Street, and people would say to me, well, where's that? And first, if I jump to the finish line, I tell you, when you see the new main library, no one will ever ask that question again because we've created that link. And that really came from the inspiration of the main New York Public Library, which at some point in their history, about 15 years ago, decided that they would do the same with Bryant Park. So we went off to look for architectural firms that were more than library architects. Library architecture was important, but we understood that we were going a step above. This was going to be about library space and civic space. And we could debate exactly what that means, and I don't know that I could necessarily define it, but it's public gathering space that the library anchors. And so as we looked at firms who had done similar projects, lo and behold, after probably 6 to 8 visits around the country with finalist architects, we said our very favorite renovation of a large main or academic library was the Thompson Library at OSU. So we asked two of the team members, Gund Architecture and Schooley Caldwell, local architect of record, to team with us, and they've done a magnificent job.
In both cases, lots of glass so that you could look out, in the case of OSU, on the quad, but at the main library in Columbus at the Topiary Park. David Zink, what about that? What's different about designing for civic space as well as a library?
Well, I think it's the focus on people. So, you know, today's library is much more a balance about people, services, and books and resources. So we really wanted to think about a space that was going to engage the community and really energize all the activities happening within the building. The location right in downtown and the possibility to connect with the downtown community in so many ways, we knew it was going to be a catalyst to, you know, having really great things happen inside the building.
I can't wait to see the building open at night from the outside, which is such an odd thing to say. What about that? What's the advantage to having people see people indoors at a library? David Zink?
Well, I think the whole aspect of seeing and being seen inspires us to take on or try things that we maybe haven't done before ourselves. So I think, as you know, Columbus sees, you know, all a diverse cross-section of their population in the library, using the resources, taking advantage of the great services that are available, meeting with each other. I think it's going to really inspire people to take that leap themselves.
Hmm. Pat Leszczynski?
Well, I think a couple of thoughts. One, there's sort of a rumor that's floating around is that, well, it's not as much of an emphasis on collections. Well, I want to make sure all of our book lovers understand that one of our eight guiding principles to the architects was we're actually showcasing the collection. But we also know that the best collection is the one that is stored in our customers' homes as opposed to on the shelves at night when we close the doors. And so we've worked really hard to, as the principal says, to showcase that collection. But that doesn't mean cavernous rows of books. That means a much more human-friendly environment for browsing and finding the materials that you want to read. And I mean, I think as Lee Rainey indicated in the earlier segment, you know, this isn't about what we did before was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Libraries are continuing to reinvent themselves to stay current as society and technology moves forward. And so that's really what this is all about. But what we found even in some of our branch libraries that have already opened as part of this overall program.
I think there's 10 other branches you're working on.
That's 10 that we're working on. 3 are open. Maine will be the fourth. What we're really seeing is even from the smaller buildings, when we bring a similar size collection to a building that is 2.5 times the size, the usage goes up 3 times. Well, why did that happen? It wasn't because there was a bigger collection, because all of our branches collectively have, or singularly, have more materials than you could read in a lifetime. But being able to access those materials and to make sure that we're accommodating more visitors into those buildings, that's what's actually generating the usage.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about libraries today, in particular, the newly renovated downtown Maine Library in the Columbus Metropolitan Library System. It's the fourth one to open in a 10 branch renovation. My guest, you just heard from Pat Leszczynski. He's the Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO. And also with us by phone, David Zank. He's principal architect at Gunn Partnership, which collaborated with Schooley Caldwell on the renovation of the downtown library. It opens this weekend as the big grand opening. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to talk about more of what's happening to welcome the reopening, more of the celebration that's occurring. But right now, we're talking about libraries. And we do have people calling about what's going on. And Barbara in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. If last month I checked out a book and then I returned it on time, next year, will somebody be able to find out that I checked out that book and use it against me?
No, Barbara. Good question. There's actually confidentiality laws as part of the Ohio Revised Code that your usage of the library is actually protected, again, with that confidentiality provision. Any time that, say, law enforcement would want to understand what anyone, you know, sometimes they may find a book on a crime scene and want to know who has it checked out, they actually have to get a subpoena from a judge in order to gain access to that information. So your records are pretty safe.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. Email from Paul, who asks, with the drastic cuts that have been made to library funding at the state level, what do you feel are the biggest challenges to the future of libraries?
Well, the funding model has absolutely changed. For the Columbus Metropolitan Library, there's two main sources of funding. The state funding, which is called the Public Library Fund, and a local property tax levy. If you look back 25 years ago, that percentage was about 20% of a local property tax levy and 70% state funding. With the reductions in state funding, those numbers have actually flipped over the course of a generation. So I think the one of the challenges that we see on the funding side is where can we make it up with private funding, as we are doing right now with a private capital campaign to supplement our public funding for all of these buildings. But also, I think everyone who is a part of the local property tax levy understands that there are limits. And so libraries are competing with schools and others as well. So state funding remains really important. And luckily, the Central Ohio delegation to a person is very supportive of the public library fund.
We were talking earlier about how although Americans like their libraries, they don't know how much libraries actually offer. And I'm wondering about how the redesign of the main library addressed this shortcoming. David Zenk?
Well, I think there were a lot of attempts in the new design to open up the library, to make a lot of those services and offerings much more visible to the visitor when they arrived. I think, you know, in some ways, the ideal library would be on one level, and it would be spread out for an infinite amount of space. But given the site constraints and the location downtown, we had to make all levels of the library sort of equally accessible and people able to discover what was there. I know one of the real treasures of the main library is the genealogy collection, and it's still on the top floor location. But I think now with the transformation of the building, it's going to feel like it's a lot closer and a lot more connected when you arrive.
Yeah, Pat Lozinski?
Yeah, I'd cite really two examples. And again, when we talked about issuing these guiding principles to our architects, the top one was transparency. And so David just mentioned the local history collection. Many people may not know that we're in the midst of just a fantastic project called the African American Digital History Project, where literally members of the community have brought their historic photos from their attics and basements and scrapbooks into our local history department. We are scanning those, using our customers to help with identification. The customers get the hard copy back and a digital copy, and now it becomes part of the library's permanent collection. But rather than just relying on you to stumble over it on our website some late night, we also have some large monitors where we will be featuring touch screens where the customers will be able to go up and explore those digital photos and in the library space, which we think will inform others about what's happening.
And these are really big monitors.
Yeah,
you could have a group of 10 or 15 or 20 people gathered around them watching what someone's doing on it.
That's exactly right. And it really is because customers do gather and collaborate. I think the other great example of that is in children's. Children's is, we call it Young Minds, our top strategy. I know, Ann, you had a chance to see the children's department at Maine. A generation ago, we tucked the story time into an alcove where if you're a parent who never participated in story time, you might think that the folks going into that special room are part of a club or they've signed up. Well, story times are now open air, and there's a gathering space in the middle of the library, but we purposefully will be conducting those story times. So those parents who are visiting that might be on the fringes and sort of looking into the inner circle about what's happening, mm-hmm. Now the staff has the ability to sort of wave them in, and it's a much more of an engaging process for our staff, and our staff is embracing that as well.
The children's library makes me want to be young again. That's what I told my tour guide, Ben Zanitsky, yesterday. Was I just want to be a kid again when I see that place.
Well, good for you, and we don't put an age limitation on how we define young minds.
I'll never grow
okay?
up. But David Zenk, what is it about a children's library now? What are the key components, not to mention the fact that they get to watch the helicopters taking off from Grant Hospital?
Well, I think CML has been really aggressive in the programs they set up for the young men. I know that the different age groups, there are some really critical points in kids' development where you can make a big difference in their reading abilities and literacy. And the programs that they have and the staff that they have there are doing an incredible job in addressing that real urgency that's out there today. And, Pat mentioned, the parents. They're a critical component in children's success. And we know that, even before kids pick up a book, the fact that parents are reading to their children makes a huge difference once they go off to school.
And so that's also a place where a parent can bring a child and read to their child in the library. It's not a place to be quiet.
No, in fact, it isn't. And, you know, the somewhat ironic thing about libraries, as we've thought more deeply about them, is it is a place where people gather to engage in a solo pursuit, right? So we want to be in the company of others while we're involved in our own thing. And of course, if it's involving collaboration in others, I mean, it's not about shouting, but it can be conversational level speaking. We try to provide spaces where people can find greater quiet. So we'll have 6 to 8 2 or 4 person study rooms. There'll be glass meeting rooms that, when they are not actually used for public meetings, they too are public spaces where the public may just be in a space that is out of talking of any kind.
We're talking about the renovation of the main library downtown. It's the fourth among 10 of the branches of the Columbus Metropolitan Library that are getting a renovation. It's the fourth to be finished. Amy in Marion Village, you wanted to ask about another section of the city. Welcome to the show. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Hi.
I didn't hear my name. Okay, so I am a lifelong resident of the Marion Village area, and I'm very happy to have the library moved into my neighborhood. It's done wonderful things for my property values, et cetera, et cetera. My objection is you are still neglecting a huge segment of our population. Have been, as far as I can remember, the furthest library south was at Midoff and Parsons. What about all those people south and east of where we are now? Because they are being ignored and have been forever.
Okay. Thanks a lot for that call, Amy.
Well, thanks for the call, Amy, as well. I'd say two things. We actually have awareness of it and actually did something. We created the new Marion Franklin Library, and those residents came to us and said, just given how that community is sort of surrounded by some railroad tracks and some freeways and industrial park, and a lack of sidewalks, something as basic lack of sidewalks was made it difficult for residents to and kids in particular to ride their bike or get to the library. So working with the Columbus City Schools, we actually have taken over the I think it's Barrett Middle School, I believe, was the mothballed school. And it's now not only a library, but there are other nonprofits in there. So it's really a community center. I think it's an important location for us. In addition, in January, we opened a branch in the southeast in Canal Winchester. Many of the Canal Winchester residents had about a 6-mile drive to our southeast branch, which is at 33 in Hamilton. So we recognize that needed to happen as well. So working with Mayor Ebert and the school system down there, we've opened that branch and it's going great. So I think that's oftentimes how these branches start out. We start with a demonstration project, if you will. When they prove to be successful, over time we try to add the library.
Thanks a lot, Amy, for that question. Are bookmobiles still a thing?
No, we've really moved away from the bookmobile, although we do have one permanently parked right now at the Northside branch. It's in the Kroger's on High Street. The Northside branch is under construction.
Okay.
And so we have it parked there with regular hours, and the customers are so grateful to have that as a place to either browse or pick up their reserves or the rest. You know, I do have to thank our listeners and our customers. They have been so patient, and we know there's an inconvenience for a city that loves libraries as much as this community does. We also know they're going to be rewarded as each one of these open up.
We're talking about the modern library today, in particular, the new main library in downtown Columbus of the Columbus Metropolitan Library System. It's the fourth among 10 to be renovated and opened. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking with Pat Lazinski. He's CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And also David Zink. He's principal architect at Gund Partnership, which collaborated with Schooley Caldwell in the design of the main branch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 16 months ago, the main library in Columbus Metropolitan Library System was closed for a $35 million renovation intended to reimagine the building's relationship with the community. The grand reopening is this Saturday, June 22nd. Still with us is Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO Pat Lisinski. Thanks again, Pat, for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
And by phone, the principal architect in the project, David Zank. Thank you, David, again for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here this morning.
The library has been an important resource for people who are homeless in Columbus, and that's not new. That's been for a long time. And there were a lot of accommodations. There were things that were done to make up for the services lost when the main library closed. Pat, what about that relationship, and how does that continue? It's part of your mission.
Well, it is, and I'm going to start by telling you that since 1907, over the front door, it has said open to all. And one of the things I'm really proud about of our library, our staff, public libraries in general, is that that's a part of who we are. That is the very fabric of, or you want to call it the cornerstone of democracy, that everyone, regardless of their place in society, has access to information. We believe that is a very strong principle. And so, yes, that includes the homeless population. We're in an urban environment. We do have homeless, and we try to take the right balanced approach to making sure that we're treating everyone with dignity and making sure that it is also a great experience for every customer. So for us, that means we've even had some grant money to have a halftime social worker on grounds mm-hmm. of the main library. But that, too, is a delicate balance because we're not trying to be the daytime homeless shelter, but we also want to make sure that we're there to serve their needs. People are homeless for a variety of reasons. And so to gain access to technology and to attempt to begin to get their feet back on the ground, we see ourselves as part of that equation. So we try to work with the other agencies as well. And, you know, we also have some simple rules. So you can't bathe at the library, but we have a list of places where you can get a shower. Mm-hmm. No one can sleep in the library. That means someone in a business suit. We're going to wake you up as well because it's a rule that it's not a loitering environment for the whole day. And so hopefully even our public appreciates that we've taken the right approach, a very respectful approach, and one that is really personified by what's over our front door.
David Zank, how do you balance the grandness of a library with its mission?
I think it's an awareness that the library offers, you know, a lot of diverse services and resources. You know, the library is trying to serve all aspects of the community, and I think CML is a great example of how that can happen. You know, and we're just talking about a group of people that, you know, they're in a tough situation right now, but I think this building offers the opportunity for them to be next to neighbors that, you know, are they're able to help, or they're able to empathize with the condition. They're able to, you know, help guide them to ways to a different situation.
Pat Lisinski, I wanted to talk about the new views of the city, because that's pretty amazing. So it's not only people see in, but people see out. We mentioned briefly that the Children's Library has an incredible view of the launching pad, the helicopter pad at Grand Hospital. But there are other views of downtown that people have really never had before.
Well, the addition that was put on really, first of all, let me talk about some of its strengths that David in 1991,
right,
that David and Bob Loversidge from Schooley Caldwell both leverage. So we have the exterior wall of the original Carnegie helps frame the atrium. And that is such a good idea. And, you know, we've just tried to enhance what's there. But you don't improve upon Vermont white marble from 1907. That's just spectacular. But the new building, we really just stripped off the veneer, which was a concrete wall, and we've replaced it with glass. So there's a couple of things going on there. David touched on it earlier. we want people to see in the library. The library itself has to market what's happening in the library, because those folks who may have never been library users because they didn't develop that habit, we want them to see their friends and neighbors and kids and the technology. So that's one of the reasons. And so for many months, I was so excited to think about how, as you mentioned, the library at night, to have it be framed by these two squares of glass and light, the Carnegie Library facade out to the west. Well, lo and behold, on the third floor now, you look out and see the entire cityscape, and to the study tables and the chairs, it's going to be favorite positioning. It's just a great dramatic space and highlights everything about our city.
Columbus is the venue this year for the World Congress of the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions, which sounds sort of boring, but it's a very big deal. It's a very, very big deal. I think they're going to be up in Dublin somewhere mostly, but you'll be leading a tour of the main library for that group. And I'm just wondering, you know, what we know about whether what's happening with the Columbus Metropolitan Library System and the main library in particular reflects what libraries everywhere are doing. Is this something they're going to see is going to look familiar or amazing?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would tell you, I think it's one of the reasons why we attracted this. So
okay.
Along with Experience Columbus and the city and the county.
And the library's reputation is...
Well, it's not only the library reputation. Again, because many residents may take this for granted, you've always lived here, there's a really important information science sector here that goes beyond public libraries. So if you think about OCLC,
right.
You think about Chemical Abstracts, even Battelle, these are information-rich companies that are serving libraries around the world. And... So when we had been invited in the past to speak about some of what we were doing in Columbus at a programming level, and coming back from a conference overseas, I assembled some of this group and I said, why don't we go after this the next time it comes to the United States? And so about 3 years ago, we actually beat out Seattle, Washington, and Washington, D.C. And so we're going to welcome, we think, between 3,000 and 4,000 librarians from around the world, August 13th through the 18th. Right now, we're up to registrations from 143 countries, and libraries really are on the map in Columbus, Ohio.
Let's talk about what's happening this weekend.
Well, we have... Today's, I've got to keep my day straight because it's been a week of previews, and we haven't held back from the public, because even as you were down in your quick tour, we're not quite ready yet. We're putting the finishing touches on. There was some welding going on yesterday.
They were still taking the wrapping off some of the lamp shades.
That's right.
That's right.
But this evening we have a reception for some of our greatest supporters and some of the folks who have helped us at a government level. And then Friday night is for all of our staff. This is new for our staff as well. So to have them come in with their family members and all of the contractors, Turner Construction, Pizzuti, our owner's rep, they will be in with their family members. They've been critical partners in this whole event. And then Saturday at noon, we will have a massive ribbon cutting across the entire front.
How many
of the
people are going to be participating in
that? I think there's 90 ribbon cutters right now. So we don't do anything small at CML. And then the doors will open. And there will be there aren't many programs on Saturday because we expect a large group
just going through the library.
Mm-hmm. There will be a program, Peanut Butter and Jazz for Kids, I think at 2:30 or 3 in the Topiary Park behind the library. At dusk, we'll be showing The Lorax out in the park, which will be fun for parents and kids. And then on Sunday, sadly, it's sold out, but we are featuring author David Baldacci will speak to 750, and that's a program funded by the Columbus Metropolitan Library Foundation Board.
Speaking of funding, Will in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Will.
Hi. And thank you for your efforts in keeping the WOSU audience informed. I'm a big fan. And, Pat, I think you lead the true crown jewel of the Columbus community. I can't thank you enough. I'm a a retired person with a fixed income. I have two pet projects that I contribute to each year, one WOSU, and second, the Columbus Metropolitan Library.
Thank you.
But obviously my funds are limited. And the thing I like about WOSU is I'm a sustaining member, and it allows me to give monthly, which is, I don't want to say it's painless, but it's less painful as to having to write that big check every year. My question is, when is Columbus Metropolitan Library kind of get into the 21st century and allow us to make that monthly contribution to you?
Oh, my gosh. Ooh. Make sure you leave your address before you hang up.
We love our sustaining members, Will, and thank you so much for your support. But Pat Lisinski, what about that?
Well, first of all, we actually do have an annual fund drive, and I appreciate the call because we are actually right now in the midst of a private capital campaign to actually get all of these projects completed. And so in addition to the tax dollars that have been put into this, the library has set out to try and raise $21.5 million. So we're at about 19.7. We are in the and it's been a quiet campaign for a couple of years, and really our corporate community and some individuals have stepped up and invested in such a big, big way. But now it is that broader campaign, and people are able to go to our website. It's greatlibrariescreate.org, and they're able to contribute right now. And if they contribute right now, we have matching dollars from the Columbus Metropolitan Library Foundation Board is matching dollar for dollar up to $105,000. So I think we are in the 21st century, and we also realize that with the pressures on tax dollars, we do need to be entrepreneurial, and we have a pretty active development campaign, but obviously we haven't hit everyone if David's asking about it.
Will, thank you so much for your call. Yep, that's okay. Thank you, Will. Appreciate that. David Zenk, are you going to come and watch people walk into the library?
Absolutely. I was out there earlier this week for some of the events. So I'll be getting on a plane in about half an hour to come back out tonight, and I'm going to stay through and see the ribbon cutting on Saturday.
What do you look for as an architect, seeing people enter a building like this?
Well, I mean, earlier this week, seeing people, looking around, their jaws dropping open, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to realize what was back there behind the Carnegie all this time, and what a few changes have made for the transformation back there.
What are you going to look for, Pat?
I anticipate a lot of smiles, and that's really the reward for myself and all of the staff. The staff have really been, this has been 16-hour days for the last month.
I saw a lot of smiles yesterday when I was walking around. They just looked excited.
They're excited because I think they know how great this project is, and I think the real joy comes from understanding that at its core, this is the public library, so it's not our house. This is what the public gets to enjoy, and we're thrilled to be stewards of it on behalf of the public.
Well, Pat Lisinski, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time. I know you're busy.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
Pat Lisinski is Columbus Metropolitan Library CEO. And David Zenk, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for inviting us.
David Zenk is a principal architect at Gund Partnership, which collaborated with Schooley Caldwell to design the new downtown main library. It's the fourth of the branches to be renovated out of 10 to go, 10 in all, in the Columbus Metropolitan Library system. Thanks to the All-Site staff today. Producer Michael DeBonis, Associate Producer Amy Jurevich, Assistant Producer Shyla Knott, All-Site's interns Summer Cartwright, Vaughn Hunt, Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All-Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.